Live in Chatham.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Talking tonight about the revels, the Christmas revels, a Cambridge, Massachusetts tradition that's now spread to a dozen cities across the United States, including Washington, Houston, Oakland, California, Boulder, Colorado, and many more. This season, they'll do 82 performances of the Christmas revels. They opened a week ago in Cambridge and are on again tonight in Harvard Sanders Theater, and again next weekend. We're talking in advance of their performance. I'm joined in the studio by George Emlin, the music director of Revels and this year's Christmas Revels, Gail Rich, executive director of the Revels, David Coughlin, lead performer and master of ceremonies in this year's Christmas Revels at the Sanders Theater in Cambridge, and Jane Tankersley, a featured singer in this year's performance. Welcome to you all.
Thank you, Tom.
I have to paint the picture. We're sitting in the studio at WBUR. We've got instruments of astounding dimensions and luster surrounding us. We've got musicians. We've got revelry in the air. And we're delighted to have you all with us. Many people from your many performances around the country will already know the Revels, but not everyone knows the Revels and what they're all about. Gail, can you fill us in on the background and what is this?
Sure. Revels actually was started 31 years ago in Cambridge by John Langstaff and his daughter Carol, but it grew from a much earlier tradition back in the 20s and probably before that, but during John Langstaff's time. His parents had annual carol parties at their home in New York, and they would invite all of their friends. Singing was an important part of the family tradition, and they would have a boar's head carol. They would have wassailing songs, you know, and they would invite families. There would be adults and children and grandparents, and they would all come and spend the evening singing.
Talk about a family tradition that grew into an enormous thing.
Absolutely.
Now they're all around the country, and what exactly do the Revels celebrate and convey?
Well, if you take that family celebration and you move it onto a stage, and we have a chorus of children, about 12 children. We have the adults that come from the community, about 26 adults that sing as a chorus. We add in a few brass musicians. We add in early musicians. We add in dancers. It's a house party gone wild. and it's fully scripted. I mean, it is a show.
And it's not traditional Christmas music as people think of Christmas music. It's not traditional carols.
It's some tradition and some not so traditional.
And every year a little bit different.
Every year is different. We set it in different time periods or in different parts of the world. So you might have a Victorian English show. You might have a medieval, a Mesoamerican.
Mesoamerican.
Show.
Yeah. There's an old-fashioned Dickensian term for you.
Right. Or a Russian revels.
And it's really celebrating not exactly Christmas, but the equinox.
That's right. It's about moving from into darkness and then back into light. And it goes way back to very pagan origins when people worried about the days getting darker. And it still affects us. Think of how many people have light boxes in their home, you know, to avoid that winter depression.
Light boxes and candles and Christmas trees and menorahs and every kind of light you can imagine. So my family has attended and enjoyed the revels many times. And I'm always struck at how it's really large. Than in any particular holiday. It encompasses Christmas, but it's really more than that. Mm. In some ways, the traditions that you celebrate go back to pre-Christian eras in the cultures that they hail from sometimes, even Mesoamerican.
Just to throw one out there.
Yeah, David Coughlin, you've been singing in the Revels for a long time. How many years now?
This is my 22nd year.
Good Lord, that's commitment.
It is, isn't it? That's a good word. Thank you for that.
what's the heart of the revels that brings you to it?
Well, aside from a performance opportunity, mm-hmm. it's a real community-based production, and not just community in that it draws from the community on stage, but the audience and the audience participation. That's the real That's the core of Revels.
Describe that participation for people who may not have
seen
it or been part of it.
Well, the audience is continuously invited to sing. They sing rounds. They sing carols. There are traditions that the audience has come to expect. For example, the Sussex Mummers Carol, we always end the show. We'll probably get to that a little bit later on. But there was one year where we didn't program the Sussex Mummers Carol, and the audience stood up and sang it anyway. So
this is a rowdy audience.
Well, they had their expectations.
Ready or not, here they come. We want to hear some more of this music. It's so great, and I want to play some to infuse our conversation. We're going to hear Masters in the Hall. Tell us about this song, George Emlyn.
Masters in this Hall is a great old French processional that we used to bring the chorus on stage down the aisle. You can hear handbells. You can hear children, early instruments. It's a wonderful way to bring the chorus into the house.
Right through the halls of the hall.
Yeah, right behind the backs of the audience.
Oh, that's great. Let's hear Masters in the Hall. Emlyn, it takes us back to a time we didn't live in, but we're happy to relive or to hear for the first time. What are they singing about?
This is Masters in this Hall's good news. Christ is born today. So it has this very Christian message, and yet for us it really is much more about community gathering together, celebrating this time of the year together. So it has this wonderful festive quality to it that we love.
What's the mix of professional singers and non-professional singers in a Revels performance?
Well, the core of any Revels performance is the amateur chorus. We audition a brand new chorus every fall and train them throughout the fall, and the same goes for children, too. These are all volunteers. We do hire people like David Coffin and James Ankersley here with us to lend a professional quality to it. The amateur quality is very important because what the audience sees and hears is very much akin to what they themselves could do and could be. Mm. They make a connection with that chorus, and they say, that could be me out there.
I could be right up there in that great costume on that lit stage.
Exactly.
See you next fall.
Yeah. you're getting me. Jane Tankersley, David's done this since the dawn of time. I think it's your first year in the Revels. Is that right?
That's right.
And so how did they snag you? How did you get involved with it, and what do you make of it?
Well, I got a phone call from George one afternoon saying, would you like to come and be a part of Revels? And
you're a New Zealander. Were you sitting in Auckland or somewhere or a little closer?
No, I live in Boston. I do live in Boston. And I'd heard about Revels. I'd never even been to a performance. And I asked a few friends about it, and they had trouble explaining what it was. And now that I'm in the middle of it, I really understand why they had trouble explaining. It's totally blown me away, the experience.
In what respect?
It's such an amazing experience. I've never been in such a performance that has such commitment in it and has such a sense of community. It's so refreshing to be in a performance where everybody's there. They really want to be there.
Is it a repertoire you've sung from before in your career?
The Tudor English repertoire is not... it's not a repertoire I've delved into.
You're a pop singer in New Zealand. Just kidding.
Oh, my wildest dreams. it's not a particular repertoire that I've done a lot of, but I do sing early music, which is sort of pre-1750, so it's a genre that I feel quite familiar with.
Gail, Jane mentions the Tudor theme, and of course that's just this year's theme.
Right.
You have a different theme every year for the Revels. Give us a sampling of that smorgasbord you've laid out over time.
Well, speaking of smorgasbords, we did a Revels that we called from the Northlands, and it included, you know, Sweden and Finland and
Iceland.
Now you're talking my country,
you know,
there, all right.
So it included all those countries. And then we've
the ski jump knows peoples.
That's right. and we've done Celtic, mm-hmm. and we've included Scottish. music in that, Irish. I mentioned earlier we had Russian show. We've had...
I saw a Sephardic, I think, Jewish tradition show one year as well.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of Middle Eastern music. And it was a village in Europe which was a crossroads for a lot of different Mediterranean cultures.
So it means all new costumes, all new theme every year.
Absolutely.
Well, our costume designer, Heidi Hermiller, is very clever. And so you might see a bit
Nip
of...
Nip and tuck, and it becomes a burqa.
Right. Exactly. You've got it. You know, a lot of our costumes, particularly for the peasants, will have many layers over them. So you might see a bit of Mexico sticking out from here or a bit of Siberia sticking out from there.
Right. So. The world turns, but the peasantry is everywhere, and we're part of it. We hail from it. This year is Tudor theme. Mm. How did you choose that?
Well, in a way, that takes us back to our roots, because this was the time in which the office of the revels was created by King Henry VII and perpetuated by his son, King Henry VIII, whom you will see on stage if you happen to come. He dominates the first half of the performance, and Queen Elizabeth dominates the second half. He decided, King Henry VII, that we needed to incorporate all these different functions of entertainment. What's that long laundry list of functions that
functions and events and
whoever the master of the music and the courts.
So he formalized this
jousting and masks.
Party
and
planner.
The party planner.
The royal party
formalized
planner.
Formalized it into the office of the revels and so that's basically where we get our name.
So it really comes from a royal office that hails from the Tudor era.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
David, what is it that people respond to in this music?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, they do, obviously. The audience. It creates a kind of a special moment for many people that punctuates the year and they look forward to it. What is that spot, that aura that the revels create?
Well, I think for a lot of people it's that chance to participate if they want to. And if they don't, there's plenty for them to listen or watch. Things are constantly changing on stage. But I think for the most part it's that participation. It's that sense of community.
And a kind of timelessness, too. I mean, we are attached through these songs... To eras long before that we still somehow have a vestigial kinship with.
Time is suspended in the theater, clearly. I know it's a bit cliche, but clichés happen.
Well, they do, and I know I've sat there and thought, what century am I in as I you know, sort of fall into the music and it seeps into my bones.
Yeah. Well, the one magical thing that we do is take music which may or may not be familiar and put it in a dramatic context so that you actually see... and hear music in a brand new light. We did a terrific Appalachian American production last year, and we had some wonderful singers from Roxbury right here in Boston who sang familiar spirituals, but to see it in the context of in which we put it gave a whole new meaning to those spirituals. So it's not that the music itself is freestanding, is so amazing, which it may be, but also that you put it into this theatrical context and it illuminates it in ways that you never would have imagined.
We're going to come back after a short break and talk about this year's revels, the revels from the Tudor era, and the theater and the music and just the whole thing. We're talking this hour about the Christmas revels with performers and the folks who put the show together from the Cambridge, Massachusetts edition of the Christmas Revels, but it's playing nationwide. Maybe it's playing in your city tonight. Don't miss it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is
special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight, reveling in the Christmas revels. They're reveling all over the country in a dozen cities right now, perhaps in a city near you. This year's theme is a Tudor theme, and from this year's show, let's listen to a bit of Blessed Be That Maid Marie.
A student of the Morris and the Clown demanded to appear before the crown, and in the courtyard, Yorick and his actors weave a royal entertainment fit for Christmas Eve.
Blessed Be That Maid Marie from this year's Christmas Revels, on tonight at the Sanders Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and on this season in many cities around the country. I'm joined this hour by George Emlyn, music director of the Revels, Gail Rich, executive director, David Coffin, a longtime performer in the Revels and this year's Master of Ceremonies, and Jane Tankersley, a featured singer in the Christmas Revels this year. We are surrounded by instruments and by music and by performers and enjoying it enormously. David Coffin, it's a Tudor theme this year. Paint a visual picture for us of what we would see on stage that conveys the time and the dress and the feeling of the Tudor era.
Well, if you look on stage, you feel like you're in the court of Henry VIII. That I think, is very clearly conveyed between the costumes and just the general demeanor and the way we walk. The way we've been taught to walk and stand and
how
reverence.
Do you walk in the Tudor era?
Well, in tights, it's a bit
is
difficult.
Is it silly walking?
No, but we do a fair amount of reverence, and I'm not quite used to that. But
what is it, bowing?
It's a certain
scraping.
Kind of bowing, yes, groveling generally. But honoring the king and then later the queen.
So you have royal figures who are part of this.
Oh, Henry VIII is very mm-hmm. present,
mm-hmm.
And his wife.
And is there drama in the sense of a storyline or just vignettes, George?
Oh, yes. It's all hung together by a man named Will Kemp, who was an actual figure, historical figure. He was in Shakespeare's company. He was the fool in many of his productions.
And so the Tudor era means the Shakespeare's era.
Exactly. Yeah, so there are references to Shakespeare. You hear little bits and pieces of Shakespeare in
And
there.
Will Kemp was someone who actually lived, who was a sort of a clown in Shakespeare's
mm-hmm,
court.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he introduces the whole show. He comes out and actually he does a flashback for us. He comes out and says, "We are about to go back into King Henry's time and see me as a young lad." So he takes us through. It's interesting because he's there in the first act as himself, as an old man, as a young man. It's quite a time shift. The continuity is provided by him. He's the one who he did this wonderful 9 days wonder where he danced from Norwich to London or London to Norwich. Yes, on a bet.
Is that in the Guinness Book of World Records?
It should have been if it wasn't.
Maybe it doesn't reach back that far.
It was a huge publicity play. I'm sure he made tons of money from it. And he, in our show, he gets in from his dance exhausted, but just in time to play the vital role of St. George in the Mummer's play, St. George and the Dragon. Great to everybody's great relief, because they've been waiting for him to come and waiting and waiting.
So, and there finally, in from his long trip,
here he is, comes just Will in Kemp. Time to come slay the dragon into the three pieces, which he does very nicely.
Will Kemp, it sounds like it could be someone you know down the street, and we're talking what, 16th century
right,
England.
Exactly.
Do the performers play a single role each or multiple roles?
The performers in the first act pretty much stay to their roles, and in the second act they shift to other roles. Will Kemp, you see him in both acts as himself.
And David Coffin is Master of Ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
Jane Tankersley, what role do you play, or how can you describe it?
Various roles. Quite often I'm introducing a piece of music. I'll sing the first verse, and then the chorus will come and join me and sing the rest of it. So I'm sort of a...
Are you a lady, a wench, something in between?
I am at one stage. I'm a wench at one stage, yes.
I mean, everybody is in one stage or another, I suppose.
Multiple personalities.
Yeah.
And I sing very sweetly and virginally, as somebody put it yesterday, at one stage as well.
Right.
So it's a multiple
right.
different roles.
Costume changes?
No, I'm at the same costume. The musicians were actually costumed as not as royalty. We're more peasant.
Hairdo, all ribboned up or not so fancy?
No, not so fancy. Hats. Everybody's wearing hats.
Is it historically correct, George Emlyn?
It's quite good. Heidi Hermiller does a wonderful job at really nailing the period. No matter whether we're talking about Romany gypsies or Appalachian or Italian Renaissance or English Renaissance, they're very different.
And Gail Rich, when you give the call for performers each year, do they show up depending on what the theme is, or do they just show up year after year to participate?
Some people show up year after year, but we also get people who show up because they're really interested in the theme. When we send out audition letters mm-hmm. or notices, we say what the theme's going to be and what mm-hmm. we're looking for. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm really feeling Tudor, this is the year for me.
Absolutely.
I'm feeling Tudor. I'm feeling pretty Tudor.
I wanted to say something about the Will Kemp, the Morris dancer. You know, a very traditional part of our revels is to have Morris dancing.
Describe Morris dancing.
It's an old form of English dancing, of men dancing, and they had bells around
their ankles.
Their ankles
or their calves.
Around their calves, and sometimes with sticks and sometimes with swords or sometimes with hankies.
But ribbons on their knees.
Ribbons and around somewhere. Their arms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a very flashy kind of dance, and it's a very...
Very trendy in San Francisco right now.
Oh, probably.
Well, we hear it is. It is. Come on. Read the newspaper.
Right.
Say it is. I'm not talking disco,
You know, because of the rebels, it's getting more and more trendy all around the country.
Oh, aren't we?
But
trendy?
Will Kemp, who was this great Morris dancer, of course, ties the Morris into the rebels this year. We've had productions where the arrival of the Morris dancers has been a bit... surprising,
mm-hmm.
because,
mm-hmm.
For instance, the Mesoamerican show.
Yeah. What does Mesoamerica mean? That's like Montezuma?
Central America. Mexican usually refers to Mexican in Central America.
Yeah. So you suddenly, you're up on a pyramid and here come these Morris dancers.
That's right. In their whites, you know.
Yeah. Whoops. Whoops. Time travel is going on.
It's one of those revels traditions.
Speaking of scary... David Coffin, you have a quite intimidating pile of musical instruments here, and they do not look like anything John Philip Sousa had his people played.
No, I
see
don't think so.
Several large animal horns and a whole lot of wood pipes. Or tell us what you've got and introduce some of your instrument friends and play them for us.
Well, this is Mike. No, these are generally they fall under the category of early wind instruments.
Okay,
I have a set of Renaissance and Baroque recorders.
They're absolutely beautiful. The color of the wood is so it's caramel rich colors and beautifully carved.
Well, this was actually locally made by Friedrich von Huene, who's one of the best recorder makers in the world, and he lives right here in Brookline.
Well, we want to be introduced to a bunch of your friends, but what is this? This is
an alto recorder,
mm-hmm.
and it's just a little bit bigger than the soprano, which most people have played in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
And
it looks about almost 2 feet long.
It's about 2 feet long, mm-hmm. I'd say, yeah.
And a beautiful caramel color. You were saying earlier that the thing that snagged you on Rebels in the first place was a particular piece of music you heard as a youth. Tell us about that, and if you can play it on this one, this
I
guy.
I should be able to play it on this.
Well, then do.
About 22 years ago, 21 years ago, back when I was just a ute, my stepmother played me.
Did you say lute?
No, but we'll get to that.
Oh, ute, okay.
Good segue.
Segue human transport. No, don't get me started. It's been a long fall. Let's stick with history. You were a ute, and you heard somebody play?
My stepmother played me the first Revels recording. And on that recording is a piece called The Abbot's Bromley.
You mean of this Revels? This
yeah.
Same?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, you are old.
Thank you.
just kidding. You were very young at the time.
And it's solo recorder, and I was a recorder player and mm-hmm. still am. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, I have to play that piece.
What was it about it?
Well, it was just a haunting, mysterious, and just completely captivating piece.
Did she play it on a record player or
on a record player? Yes, this was exactly. Yep, and it didn't skip, fortunately, or I would have learned it wrong. Uh-huh. And
how old were you? Do you think at the time?
I was 20.
And it
got me.
Pierced you.
Well, I'd been playing the recorder since I was four, so mm-hmm. Recorder music was very much in my blood. Mm-hmm. But the tune itself just reached out of the speakers and grabbed me by the throat and said, you must do something with me.
And it has never let you go. Let us hear it.
It hasn't. And the only place I could think of to use the tune was mm-hmm. in Revels. It's mm-hmm. not a concert piece. It's mm-hmm. not something you can put just anywhere. And it needs a context, and Revels was it. So that's what got me into Revels.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's
ages.
Abbot's Bromley, the tune that rules the man.
And the tune, it repeats itself. And
We're hooked.
Well, on stage, it's very dark, and there are the Morris men with antlers on their head.
What an image.
And some supernumerary figures.
Supernumerary. You don't see those every day anymore.
A man, woman, a child, a hunter, and they follow each other around on the stage, and they do this figure dance, and it's very ritualistic, and comes from the town of Abbot's Bromley, where this dance is still performed to this day.
We understand how you got hooked. Wow. Well, who else is in your great pile here? There's a horn. There's a piece of an animal on the table in front of us.
This is an African ox horn. It's called a Gem's horn. Mm-hmm. Hollowed out African ox horn.
It's beautiful. It's gray, going to a long black tip. It's that kind of curving, conical shape. Yep. Very long and slender.
Closed at the end.
Okay.
And you blow just like a recorder.
So there's a flute carved
the
or a recorder carved into this.
Exactly. And it goes. You can date this back to the early 1400s, and basically lost popularity in the 1600s, but survives as an organ pipe.
Play something
today,
for us.
But it sounds like this. Just a little taste of the game.
Now, I have to ask, George Emlyn, did Tudor period musicians have African horns to play on?
No, they didn't. They probably didn't. What do I?
So it probably was a local cow that donated
this was the
horn.
Ox, exactly. Yes, this was the retired ox to be taken out to pasture. Might as well use his horn for something. Sure. David's is a modern made instrument, but in those days, it would have been the local cow, or goat, or sheep.
Beautiful, beautiful things. I hope we get to hear more of those. I also want to hear Jane Tankersley sing for us for a moment. Jane, you've got such a wonderful voice, and there's a song that you sing in these Revels, the Western Wind, 16th century love song. If we can get you to stand up at this mic and give us a bit of it, we'd love to hear it. We heard just a little bit in the break, and this was the pop song of the day, Jane tells us. It truly was a popular love song Britney Spears, top this, forget about it.
Yeah.
This is Jane Tankersley singing The Western Wind.
Western wind, when will thou blow? The smiling dawn can rain. Christ, if my love were in my arms,
Western Wind, sung by Jane Tankersley, performing tonight in the Christmas Revels. Wow, that is completely fantastic. George, is it literally appropriate to call that a pop love song of that period? Would everybody have known it in the streets of London, or many people?
I wonder about that. It was a composed song. It certainly would have been known in the courts.
So in the courts, at least, which was a culture into itself.
And in the homes, because there was a rising middle class during the 16th century, and they might have known it, too, if you had enough money to hire a musician to come in and play for you. Yes.
We are having a lot of fun with the Revels this hour, and we are looking at a Tudor period, including the Queen. She makes an appearance in the show, is that not right?
Yes, in the second act.
And we have a clip, Deo Gratias, is that right?
Yes, by William Byrd.
Let's hear it. Gemlin, what did we see on the stage behind that music?
Well, that was now we see the Queen. Everybody has been expecting her, and we were just about to shout, "Long live the Queen! Vivat Regina!" And she's decked. She's splendid. She is splendid.
Can you picture it? It's a Tudor theme this year at the Revels. We're celebrating music of a long time ago, music that still lives today. This is special coverage from WBUR. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Christmas Revels. Tankersley and the female chorus singing O Comely Queen, introducing Queen...
Queen Elizabeth I.
Queen Elizabeth I, as she makes her great entrance in this year's Tudor-themed Christmas revels. Jane Tankersley is in the studio with us. Jane, what are those very explicit kind of lines praising her physical presence we just heard?
They're just wonderful. Listen to what... Thy stately grace, thy favor fair indeed, thy pleasant hue and countenance, all others doth exceed. That's just one of them.
Oh, comely queen. Did comely mean the same thing in Tudor England that it means, not that we use it much now, but it means kind of foxy, doesn't it?
It just means lovely.
Just lovely. Okay, I see. There I go. There I go again.
Yeah. I think you're projecting.
Foxy
nice
might not
at.
Have been in use back then.
Maybe not. Well, the fox hunt,
the
though.
Hunts, yes.
There's always a connection. We're talking this hour about the revels, and I wanted to get into a couple of things here. First of all, about the audience that comes to the revels. It's not like just paying your whatever it is and showing up and sitting separate from the stage and from the performance. They're really part of it, and it's become part of many people's holiday tradition, both in the equinox, mm-hmm. or the solstice, I should say, and for the vernal equinox. Mm-hmm. What gets that implanted?
One of the things that we talk about a lot is ritual. And I think that what we have done is to create a ritual by drawing on other cultures, the rituals of other cultures around the world and in different times. But you're right, our audience comes with a sense of expectation that something wonderful is going to happen, that they're going to hear some familiar things that they hear year after year, but also some new and exotic things they've never heard before. And that expectation, this annual expectation, is a ritual in itself. So, yeah, it's a wonderful audience. It's an amazing phenomenon.
And, Gail Rich, what do you think this music taps in people? I mean, it's not as though they're trained by radio day in and day out to listen to it or for it, but yet clearly there's something here, something about the season, something older than the rhythms of what's on the top 40 charts that we get trained to today.
Well, it's interesting that all of our Revels companies take place in major metropolitan areas of the country. We don't have them really in rural areas, with the exception of Hanover, New Hampshire. Although that's where...
So are you saying that you're prejudiced against farmers?
I'm saying that the people came from the farms to the cities, or they were born in the cities. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you really miss in the cities are, you know, the earth under your fingernails, under mm-hmm. your toes. Mm-hmm. And people feel, have this very deep need to reconnect with the earth. And Revels performances, in a sense, do that. But there's something that I think is equally as deep. Part of what happened when people moved to cities and in our current society is that families have spread mm-hmm. all over the country. So how many of us have, you know, all of our family members in the same little village that we live in? And people need a sense of that larger village. Mm-hmm. And when you come to a revels, that sense builds during the first act. And I always think the most important part of the entire revels mm-hmm. is moving into the intermission where people have been singing together, and suddenly the people from on stage come into the audience and they take their hands and they take people out into the audience, and everybody joins in just a simple dance and song together. And that's the pivotal point. That's when an audience of 1,100 people become a village.
And are transported.
They're transported. And when they leave the theater, they're still in that village. And as a result, for thousands of families, coming to the revels is an important ritual and tradition in their families.
It does cast a spell. Now, in fairness, I've been to rock concerts that cast a spell. People go out and they feel like they've shared something. Their fingers or tips are all burnt from holding their lighters up. But is it the same, or is it some other kind of shared experience here?
I think this is deeper, but that's my personal
opinion.
I've been to a few rock concerts.
We've got a Revels bias.
Pretty interesting.
It's great. It's great. Our time is running down, and I've enjoyed this so much. When we do go out, we're going to hear Lord of the Dance. Now, this also has an audience participation piece to it.
That's the one Gail was referring
just what,
to.
That's right. That's what you're just describing, mm-hmm. when everyone's winding through the hall, mm-hmm. and it's a great scene. Jane, it's your first year. Will you do it again, or am I getting in the way of your contract negotiations?
I would love to do it again. It's been such a great experience. It's been so much fun. Incredible amount of fun. And I've met so many new people, which is just wonderful.
And I guess I have to ask you all, we don't have much time left, but in some way the resonance of this particular season, with all the tragedy and then trauma of this fall. Can you feel it in yourselves when you perform? Can you feel it in the audience? Are they especially looking for that still, that transported place this year, David?
I feel it a lot on stage, and I like to think I'm not projecting, but I feel like the audience really is tighter. There's a closeness this year that I haven't felt in the past.
Tight in the sense of bound closely to one another.
Exactly. Mm. And it's a wonderful feeling. It's very heady. To be on stage
and feel it coming back
with all of these people singing together like that.
It's been great having you all this hour. We've been talking with David Coffin, Master of Ceremonies in The Christmas Revels, with Jael Tankersley, a featured singer you heard sing so beautifully before, Gail Rich, Executive Director of The Revels, and George Emlyn, Music Director. The Revels are selling, or will have, their millionth guest tonight in Sanders Theater at Harvard University. Wow, that says a lot, coming out of carols sung in a family hall. And keep on singing. We love it. We'll go out with Lord of the Dance. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In a moment, I'll be joined by special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie. But first, let's listen to some sounds from this past week.
As coalition forces overtake the last few caves in Afghanistan, senior Bush advisors for the first time are not ruling out that Osama bin Laden may have escaped.
I would like to say here that the government of Ariel Sharon is now launching a war against the Palestinian National Authority, against its institutions.
Security has been tightened in Delhi amid this escalation of tension. The Indian government is under pressure to take strong action. The cooler heads are calling for restraint, but nothing is being ruled out.
I was a student in Pakistan, studying Islam. The people there in general have a great love for the Taliban. My heart became attached to them. I wanted to help them one way or another.
I think what they would like is for you all to write that they'd pass something and the Senate hasn't, that they will attempt to portray that as an effort to defeat economic stimulus.
Not only the suicide bombers, but also those who are shooting Israelis. All this must stop. Arms has to be taken away from those groups of terror. That has to be proven on the ground before we know we have a real ceasefire.
That was Yasser Arafat condemning Israel. Sounds from the India-Pakistan standoff. John Walker Lind in a tape. Tom Daschle on the stimulus program that went nowhere, and an Israeli spokesman on the ceasefire. Jack Beattie, what is catching your eye this week?
Well, you know, Tom, what struck me this week was the emergence of normal politics. Senator Daschle put it well when he said economic issues are the philosophical basis for identification of the two parties, by which he meant the economic issues posed by the stimulus bill. The Republicans wanted income tax breaks mostly for the well-off and for corporations. The Democrats wanted tax cuts for lower-income Americans.
And never the twain did meet this week.
And, you know, it was interesting. This was the first time that the Bush tax-cutting juggernaut has been stopped. He had it all his own way last year, from personal income tax rate cuts to the estate tax cuts. This is the first time it's been stopped, and the man who stopped it was Tom Daschle. He's being demonized by the GOP. Ads were taken out against him in South Dakota depicting him arm-in-arm with Saddam Hussein.
Oh,
so he's going to take it on the chin, but on the other hand, he's playing to his own future prospects as a Democratic presidential contender in 2004.
Jack, he's set on that, but does the end of that juggernaut mean anything more than the switch of party dominance in the Senate?
I don't know. We'll just have to see. But he's got the attention of Democratic activists by essentially stopping for the first time and in these very difficult conditions the Bush tax cut program. And by the way, President Bush today in an offhand comment didn't seem all that upset that this program didn't go through. Throughout, this has been driven by the House Republicans who are to the right even of this administration on tax cuts.
But if the economy continues to go south, doesn't turn around as people hope and expect it may, boy, the cudgels will be out over who lost the stimulus package.
They sure will. Some people think that the economy is going to right itself without the stimulus. And in any case, it was hard to make the case that the stimulus, given the size of the economy, was going to make any substantial difference. It will make a difference, of course, to unemployed people to get an extension of their unemployment benefits. And Senator Daschle wants to do that in January.
And on the other side of the world, Jack, we talk a lot about the war being over, but we have U.S. Special Forces deep in the caves beneath Tora Bora searching crevice by crevice. It ain't over.
It ain't over. By a poll in the Washington Post today, 2-1, the public says that the war will not be a success without the death or capture of bin Laden and without the removal from power of Saddam Hussein. Well, leave aside Saddam Hussein.
There's an agenda.
And meanwhile, of course, the entire Taliban leadership has melted back into the population of Afghanistan, and none of the captured al-Qaeda members are believed to be senior people. So thus far, we really haven't closed the gap with bin Laden, and the week began with the Christian Science Monitor reporting that he had slipped into Pakistan, and there's more talk of that. So it looks like 2,000 to 3,000 American troops were going to be there till the spring looking for him, and perhaps even looking for him in Pakistan, which raises another problem. The administration froze the assets of a Pakistani group that was allied with the terrorists who attacked the Indian Parliament.
Yeah.
And this is a serious blow for Musharraf, an embarrassment, according to one diplomat, because the drive to liberate Kashmir is part of the sort of national identity of Pakistan. And this particular group was, in fact, trained by the Pakistani army. So on the one hand, we may be asking him to go into Pakistan to look for bin Laden. And on the other, we're putting a strain on him by saying to him, look, you've got to give up the violent struggle for Kashmir. It's quite a pressure point for him.
Jack, do you sense George W. Bush fearing a reprise of his father's non-capture of Saddam Hussein and this non-capture of Osama bin Laden?
God, that haunts this thing, doesn't it? Huh? That President Bush, the first President Bush, left Saddam in power, and thus far, bin Laden hasn't been captured. And the public now wants both of these people, Saddam and bin Laden, to be removed. So, the administration, by focusing on one man, sort of dug itself into a hole, or at least thus far it has, that unless they get that one man, it won't look to the public, at least now, as a success. Of course, it has been a success. I mean, we have destroyed a lot of the infrastructure of these terrorist camps. We've prevented Afghanistan from being a base. So there's been a great deal of success, but to the public, so long as bin Laden's at large, it isn't a success.
And U.S. troops are on the ground. Jack, have a great holiday.
And to you, too, and all our listeners.
This is special coverage from WBUR. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Good night.